ya lo hace, pierna derecha, directo al arco, golazo, golazo.
The world of football with a soccer perspective. This is Soccer Today with Dwayne Mullins and Kevin Larame, live on the Sports Podcasting Network.
Good day, good night, and welcome to Soccer Today for Tuesday, December 11th, 2018. Today on the show to wrap up our season 4 of Soccer Today, one of our favorite guests ever, Jonathan Tannenwald, to talk about the Women's World Cup draw that happened this weekend. Jonathan, how are you doing today?
Your list of guests must be pretty short if I'm one of the best ones.
We said favorite, not best, Jonathan. Favorite, not best. It's anyway. Yeah.
Same deal. Let's start with
okay, fair enough. Let's start with the Women's World Cup. Obviously, Kevin and I talked a little bit about Canada's draw yesterday, so we'll start with the American draw. Are you happy with it? I mean, happy is a strong way to put it for you as a journalist, but do you think that American fans should be happy with this draw?
You know, it's interesting. I think American fans should be very happy with this draw because they get to go to a game at the Parc des Princes in Paris on a Sunday.
Okay.
However, that comes at a little bit of a cost. And that cost is potentially having to play France in the quarterfinals. Now, I don't know whether you guys talked about this yesterday because I did not have time to listen to yesterday's show. I was scurrying around working on a story that not related to this, that went up this morning. The way FIFA set this up is really rather problematic. Because you would think, fellas, that playing in Paris is the plum assignment, right? For any team in this World Cup?
Sure.
Well, there's not a lot of games at the Parc des Princes, A. And B, other than the host, France, there was only ever one number one seed that was going to play in Paris, and that was Group F. So just when we thought we all had everything worked out, you guys might have seen the day before the draw, Henry Bushnell of Yahoo Sports noticed that when you laid out the round of 16, there were four group winners in one half and two in the other. So he wrote to FIFA to request a clarification. And wouldn't you know, the day before the draw, FIFA changed the match schedule that they had published and said it was a clerical error. It had been right all along, of course, right?
Yeah.
So then you ended up with a scenario in which the only way that a one seed would play in Paris other than France would be to play France in the quarterfinals. So I'm sitting there thinking either the U.S. is not going to play in Paris at all, which the fan base wouldn't really like. And I dare say the FIFA ticket sales office wouldn't really like, for reasons I'll get into in a minute. Or the U.S. is going to have to play France in the quarterfinals. And lo and behold, the U.S. is going to have to play France in the quarterfinals. So tell me this, fellas. There's 24 teams in this World Cup. I count two that can fill the house at the Parc des Princes, France and the United States. How many more are there?
Maybe the Dutch might travel.
Yeah, England, the Dutch, outside of that.
I don't think England. I think the Dutch can. I do not think England can. That was my first hot take of the day.
Maybe not fill, but at least there'll be some travelers, some fans. But yeah, I wouldn't count on Spain. Neither do Italy. No. And yeah, I think you're right.
So yeah. We agree that it is to the benefit of the World Cup to have the United States playing in Paris. Obviously, it's the benefit of U.S. television to have that game be on a Sunday because it would do a big number. And they moved the kickoff times around a little bit that day. So the U.S. game would be later in the day. It was originally going to be at 9 a.m. Eastern, which is 6 a.m. out west. It got moved to noon Eastern so folks on the West Coast can watch it. That was a smart little move, as we say. Now, I brought a prop, fellas.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. Brought a big old legal pad. Flipping it up and down like that because I have written down some predictions.
Okay.
Are we predicting today?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Sure. Why not?
Would you like to know where I think Canada is going to finish in Group E?
Let me just brace myself. Let me just brace myself. Okay, you can go.
Second, at least.
Second, I'm, correct.
Yeah.
Which is too bad. Canada-Netherlands game is number one on my list of games to watch.
It's a very interesting game. I saw it at the World Cup 4 years ago, and the Dutch gave them everything they could handle that day when Canada was the favorite, so I can only imagine this time, yes.
The Dutch are very good. And it quite surprised me that they fell into that playoff, because they should be better than that. I got France and Norway coming out of Group A, and that's assuming Ada Hegerberg does not play. We might hope for a resolution in that situation at some point, and I don't claim to say how it should happen. I just hope it gets resolved, because the World Cup would be better with her.
100%. You know, yeah, 100%.
Et cetera. I got Germany and China coming out of Group B, which is going to surprise some people, I think. I got Australia and Brazil coming out of Group C, which isn't going to surprise anybody. England and Japan coming out of Group D. I have England winning that group, but not by much. I'm willing to give them a little bit of home field advantage playing in Europe. You know, that might be just enough to get them over Japan, but not by much. And I'm glad that the English media, you know, caught something that, you know, I certainly noticed along the way, and it was why I was hoping the U.S. would not get drawn into Group D. They have to go Nice, Le Havre, Nice, Valenciennes in their first four games. That's a lot. I mean, it's relative, because it's France. The country isn't very big. But you know what I mean. You're going up and down twice.
Fair enough. Yeah, it's still 900 kilometers or something. So right. 600 miles for that distance, for sure.
And if they finish second in their group, they go to Rennes, which is in northern France, too. So it's, you know, they got the short end of the stick in that regard. Netherlands, Canada, 1-2 in Group E. USA, Sweden, 1-2 in Group F. And then I looked at what I had, and I just picked the four third-place teams that who knows? With the third place teams. Mm-hmm. I went this time with South Korea, Spain, Scotland, and New Zealand.
Sure.
So here we go. Norway, Brazil, Germany, South Korea, England, New Zealand, France, Scotland, USA, China, Sweden, Canada, Australia, Spain, and Netherlands, Japan. Sweden-Canada matchup might actually be better for you guys.
I know, I've said that already. Canada almost wants to finish second in that group, but yeah. Yes.
And then the irony is that if the U.S. deliberately tanks to get Sweden into the number one spot and send them off to get eaten up by France, the U.S. plays Canada in the round of 16, which I think and then Netherlands in the quarters. I believe, I'll double check that in a second. But, I don't think the U.S. wants to play Canada in a knockout game, even though I think the U.S. would win. I think Jill Ellis was right to say, you know what, we just want to go out there and win everything. I think that's the right way to go about it.
I don't think I think the U.S. probably doesn't want their ankles kicked in that game.
They're going to get kicked in enough already between now and then.
Yeah.
And you know what they say about he who or she who chooses, eh? She who chooses wrong. Worse. That one.
That's correct. All right. The prop. It's a dramatic flipping of the page of the legal pad right into my microphone. Brazil, England, France, USA, Australia, Netherlands, and Germany, Canada. And your semifinals are Brazil or England versus France or the USA. And Australia or the Netherlands versus Germany or Canada. Subject to future revision, fellas, but that's what I think so far.
Yeah, well, that's not a bad prediction. I think anyone who picks the U.S. to not be the favorites going into this is being a bit silly, although the French might have something to say about it. Certainly, it's the enigma. They're the Washington Capitals of women's football, Jonathan.
Don't do that to me. That's the wrong time for that, to tell that to her. To a U.S. women's soccer team fan living in Washington, I think it's the wrong time to tell them that.
There you go. There you go. Jonathan, quickly, before I let Kevin jump in, in terms of the U.S.'s draw, though, they have what I think are arguably the two weakest teams in the tournament, in Thailand and Chile, in the draw. Is that a positive or a negative, do you think?
Well, I think it's a positive, and I'm going to quibble a little bit with your characterization of those two. I mean, by the FIFA rankings, they're fairly far down. I feel bad for Argentina, because I think they can score, and they're just going to get run over by that group. But, Thailand can sit back and play some defense, as we've seen. Chile, I'm not so sold on. And there are some other teams floating out there, especially Italy, that I'm really not sold on. I think the U.S. is going to win this group, but I think that Thailand game, you know, they've been spending all these years, you know, really loading up the arsenal to break down a bunker, and they're going to have to go out there and do it.
This World Cup being held in Europe, and with the rise of the European women's game over the last 4 years since the last World Cup, is there a chance in your mind, Jonathan, that outside of the USA, the second favorite and the second, third best team could be European teams?
Why not? The only other one's Australia, right?
Yeah.
Yep, Australia would be another contender, but France, especially France over the last few years, England as well, and especially when you look at the rise of the club games, I see the U.S., and I see the other favorite as France, of course, at home. It does bring a certain advantage, and England, and even Spain, having watched a U-17 Women's World Cup, like Spain in 4 to 8 years will be a force to be reckoned with. So it's fascinating to see the rise of traditional soccer countries into the women's game using the infrastructures and the tactics and techniques that they have been working on the men's game, and finally finding a way to transpose that into the women's game, which eventually could be dangerous for the rankings of a Canada and even USA.
Yes, but this is where I get a little cynical. Spain has been doing very well, and yet I cannot help thinking that their federation is going to put a ceiling on it and not let them reach their full potential. I look at Mexico's run in the Under-17 World Cup, and I think to myself, that's great. What is the Mexican Federation going to do to ensure that they actually develop into what they can be at the senior level? Now, that does not excuse the U.S. Soccer Federation by any stretch, because they have still much to do and more to do. But ultimately, when these senior level tournaments come around, we see who takes it seriously and who doesn't.
Fair enough, Jonathan. There was a little bit of other news that came out of the women's game on the club side this week. That would be that Visa came on board as a major sponsor for the UEFA Champions League. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on what that will mean in terms of the power dynamic in club football. Is that just another move towards maybe Europe one day surpassing the NWSL in terms of the best leagues in the world?
Did we? I did not see any reporting on how much money Visa is putting in the pot.
Fair enough.
So it dovetails. I mentioned that I was out scurrying about writing a story yesterday, and it dovetails with that story I was writing, in fact, because one of the minority owners of the Philadelphia Union is starting a creative agency to connect for brand, he wants to go out and get the brands that want to get in front of the American soccer fans between now and 2026 and 27 and 28. And one of the people he hired, which is why I wrote the story, is one of the big higher-ups at the U.S. Soccer Federation, who's been involved in hiring Ernie Stewart and Greg Berhalter, but also has a lot of background on commercial side. Or some on the commercial side. His title is Chief Soccer Officer. He's involved in a lot of administrative and development stuff at U.S. Soccer. His name is Ryan Mooney. You guys might have seen it out there every once in a while. He's coming to Philadelphia to work in this company alongside a couple guys who've worked at Adidas and Under Armour over the years. And I sat down yesterday with Richie Graham, who was the union's minority owner, who's running this thing. And I asked him, you know, where does women's soccer fit for you in this, you know, in this agency that you're going to be running? And he said, I think it needs to. Obviously, that's a huge part of the American game and the American identity. It needs to be a massive piece. And then he further said it would be foolish to not have a focus on that side. And when you think about the fabric of American soccer, there's no doubt that a big piece of it is the women's side of the game. And I was chatted for a while with him afterwards because I know him well and we shoot the breeze often enough. And one of the things I said, and one of the reasons why I'm interested to see whether entities like this and some of the others out there are able to succeed in the realm of women's soccer, is that we in the sport know that the demand is there and that the demand is not being served by media sponsors, etc. So who can go and make the case to the corporate side of things where the money is that if they make that investment, it will return a profit to them? Now, that's not your and my job in the media per se. I mean, we can go and stand on the soapbox and say it, but it's not our job to actually make those connections, you know? But something like this, they can actually go out and do it. I'll be interested to see if it happens. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. And it'll be something to keep an eye on to see the ramifications of those moves. Speaking of the ramifications of, last Saturday, Jonathan, was Major League Soccer's last big hurrah of 2018 on the field. MLS Cup, Atlanta United 2, Portland Timbers 0. I'm wondering, what's your overall thought on MLS Cup and maybe wrapping up the 2018 season as well?
You got a sound effects box up there?
Cash register? Ka-ching,
ka-ching. Yes. Ka-ching. 73,000 ka-chings, gentlemen. Hit that, you know, a lot of money. Which is good. For those of us who have wanted soccer in North America to be big, not just, you know, the little hipster garage band thing that people use to feel, you know, have their little moral superiority edge, et cetera, because it's cool and exclusive, but like actually big. This was big, and it is big, and it's been very impressive to see it be that. And it has been big in Toronto, and it has been big in Montreal, and it has not been big in Philadelphia. And I wrote a 1,000-word column about that for the MLS Cup final. And as of yet, nobody has told me that I'm wrong. And because I'm not wrong. It was very impressive to see. It was very impressive to see Atlanta not only win, but play good soccer in doing it. And they have raised the bar, and we will see what happens with whoever is going to be their next manager, and when Gonzalo Martinez comes in from River Plate, whether he can fully replace Miguel Almiron and whoever else ends up leaving. And as I wrote toward the end of the game on Saturday night, Ezequiel Barco, it's your team now. So we'll see. But it was very impressive. And I think that the league has a lot to be proud of. And it is absolutely right to say that Atlanta has raised the bar, not only for what we can dream of, but what can actually be done.
Fair enough. Well, speaking of that segue, and we'll end it with this, Jonathan, we have a new team in Cincinnati, which we've seen a lot of success off the pitch for at the USL level. What are you expecting from them both on and off the pitch next year?
I don't know. It will be interesting to see whether these guys who they had in the USL can cut it in MLS, especially the ones like Jimmy McLaughlin and Emery Welshman, who had their cups of tea in the league over the years. Can they do it now? And I've heard a lot of people saying they think they can't, but I remember people saying the same thing about Christian Ramirez and Miguel Ibarra when Minnesota United came up, and that turned out that they did pretty well. So we'll see.
Yeah, no, it'll be interesting too. Blake Smith, former Montreal Impact player, Montreal Impact draft pick, is going to make the jump too with FC Cincinnati. No, it's fascinating to see Cincinnati's roster building with USL presence more than I actually expected.
Yeah, well, and we'll see who they pick up today in the expansion draft. There are some interesting names out there, and I have written, trying to pull my story up real quick. A name that would certainly be familiar to you guys, who I think that perhaps it would be in their interests, Dwayne, if they would go get Steven Betashore.
100%. I still think that's one of the biggest mistakes the TFC made in the offseason, was letting a veteran like that go.
And Kevin, let me ask you this. Were you surprised that Montreal put Anthony Jackson-Hamel up for the take?
No, not surprised at all. Not surprised at all. I'm actually surprised that he's still part of the roster and wasn't traded last Sunday. But no, Montreal has to find a way to resolve this situation with Anthony Jackson-Hamel and Rémi Garde. And one of the best way to do it would be, well, they're actually probably really hoping real hard that Cincinnati picks him today, because that would be of service to the Montreal in the mind of Rémi Garde and is a technical staff.
Would it be well, I think I've said this on the show before, so I might as well say it again. The rumor is about Jackson-Hamel, and I've heard this for a long time, and I could say this about any number of people that I've heard it about over many years. But I'll say, I have heard that he is not the best practicer in the history of creation.
That's 100% correct. What's actually there too is his belief about what he can bring to the team without actually showing Rémi Garde that and just telling him, look what I did the year before you arrived. And the communication channels between the two have gone, taken a turn for the worse during the season. And he doesn't practice in a way that would make Rémi Garde feel comfortable bringing him to the games. And that's what Rémi Garde said many times during the season without pinpointing players. But it's one of the reasons why he was not turning around at his bench and using his bench fully all year long, because he said many times those words saying, look, I don't see it in practice, people that can actually do it and help us in the game situation. And if I don't see it in practice, I'm not going to gamble. I'm not going to choose that player from the bench if I don't see it in the league leading up to the game. So the practice aspect and the effort given in everyday situation, I think, was the biggest problem with Anthony Jackson-Hamel and the Montreal Impact this season.
Now, Dwayne, I look down the 401 and I see Tosin Ricketts and Josie Altidore and any number of other guys who put the work in and are rewarded for it. And if I'm the kind of player who puts the work in and then somebody else who just has a bigger name than me gets to play on Saturday and doesn't put the work in, that comes up in the locker room every now and again in some situations.
Well, sure. I mean, Kevin's talking about a young Canadian. There's another young Canadian in Toronto that's still technically, you know, in the plans, maybe, in Jordan Hamilton that maybe meets the same criteria. Jordan Hamilton hasn't had as much success in MLS, but has long touted as having the same level of potential, if not more. So, yeah, this is the great dilemma of the Canadian player over the years that have been the large fish in the tiny little puddle, and then they get to another level where they have to get pushed, and they don't always follow through. So, hopefully we can find something in the future that doesn't happen.
Some of that's on the player. That's my point.
Sure.
Yep, I agree. And it'll be a fascinating day starting at 2 p.m. this afternoon. FC Cincinnati will make their expansion draft with the five players they have a chance to pick today. Jonathan, we want to thank you for your time today. Today's our season end. We're wrapping up our season, taking a short break and coming back next week re-energized. But before that, we want to wish you, I know your holidays just finished, but happy holiday season as a whole. And thank you very much for your contribution all season long, Jonathan.
It's my pleasure, fellas. We'll talk in the new year. I'll be in Chicago for the coaches' convention, as I love to do, staking out the hotels where everybody's staying and see who you come across.
Yeah, absolutely. One day I'll be at that convention. And thank you, Jonathan, once again. We'll take a quick break and come back with our wrap-up of the season. A bit of talk about, well, the world of football with a soccer perspective.
You are listening to Soccer Today. Follow us on Twitter at @SoccerTodaySPN and like our Facebook page, facebook.com/sportspodcastingnetwork. You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcast.
And we're back on Soccer Today. You can follow Jonathan on Twitter for his soccer coverage at The Goalkeeper. I'm at Kevlar. I'm at Dwayne's at 24th Minute. And the show at Soccer Today SPN. Like we mentioned, it's the end of our regular season for 2018. We'll have a few more shows this year for sure. But we're taking a bit of a break until the middle of next week probably. And we need to recharge the battery and go traveling a bit, see the world, see family, see open the blinds. But wow, it's sunny. Yeah, I haven't looked outside since March. But no, it's going to be a fun time, Dwayne. But before we go on our little holiday break, we have to talk about a few things in Major League Soccer and in the world of soccer as a whole. You know, Montreal Impact did a few trades this Sunday, Vancouver Whitecaps as well. Vancouver Whitecaps really present and active in the player movement situation. But I kind of felt bad for Maxime Crépeau, Dwayne, for this reason. Maxime Crépeau gets traded. All right, he's going to get his opportunity. Oh, Zach McMath has signed as well. He's been traded to the Vancouver Whitecaps. And Maxime Crépeau finds himself in the middle of another fight for playing time at an MLS level.
Yeah, I mean, in this particular case, first off, what the hell's Colorado doing? But anyway, in this particular case, I think he might have a better chance to break through. Also, the Whitecaps, I don't know if they know exactly what they're doing with their keeping situation. There's been some changes there that might lead to a new keeping opportunity. So I do think there's a chance there for Crépeau. It made sense that he had to be traded to a Canadian team. I'd have to look at his eligibility requirement in terms of whether he's domestic league wide. He may not have been in the academy long enough.
He was in the academy before, I think it counted. But when I was listening to Mark DeSantos talk about his two new goalkeepers, both of them are considered domestic for the Vancouver Whitecaps, right? Zach Math, American; Maxime Crépeau, Canadian. Both are domestic, and that was a big part of it because they want to save their international spots for other position on the roster.
Well, and look, not to toot my own horn, but I thought that their move, like, I never understood what the Whitecaps were doing on that position when they moved out and brought the New Zealander in, and it didn't make any sense to me. They weren't getting much of an upgrade for using an international spot. It was always illogical. The keeping position is one that you really want to be domestic. It doesn't make sense to me unless you're bringing in, I don't know, like, name a keeper, you know, the second coming of Buffon. Unless you're bringing someone of a world class level in, to spend that kind of money, like Julius Cesare here in Toronto. They say like he was coming in as a loan, and you know it was nice to have see that little TFC banner beside Brazil at the World Cup in Brazil. But really, other than that, what was it doing? I mean, it didn't really make a lot of sense.
I forgot about Julius Cesare being a Toronto FC player.
He was only a Toronto FC player for 4 months, so he wouldn't. It's not really much to forget about, but nonetheless, it was. Yeah, it's just not a position that you don't. It's a position that you should be filling with domestic players, 100%. And the one thing I will say about Kripo is obviously there with a Canadian manager who is more than willing to give Canadians a chance of showing a consistent ability, consistent. There's no lack of reluctance to show Canadians an opportunity, and you know they have to earn it clearly. But as we're talking about the last segment with Johnson, but I do think that Kripo will get a full opportunity to excel in Vancouver if in fact he takes that. You know, they did also mention yesterday that the MDS was talking about the U23 program at the Whitecaps Academy and how he wants to get them something like 30 games next year. There's not a league that they're going to be in.
Where? Like against
which
is each
a bit
other?
Odd.
Against each other? It'll be like playing against what, the Pacific FC in the exhibition games? Or I don't know.
I'm sure they'll play in tournaments or something. Yeah, it's going to be maybe against the reserve teams of the Canadian Premier League. There might be opportunities here and there against university teams. That will probably be what they do. But, I mean, I think that probably what Mark DeSantis is saying with that is he is getting out in front of something, saying that this is he wants this to be part of the Whitecaps' identity again. Because I really do think, you know, I kind of made a tweet about it yesterday where I was being a bit sarcastic with it. The Whitecaps for years always held themselves up as this, like, you know, beacon of hope on the development side. And I really think they've dropped the ball there in recent years. They have not prioritized it at all. The fact that they dropped the USL team, I get that it's expensive, but if you're going to be a development team, if that's going to be in your DNA, then you need to make that you need to make that investment. And they haven't, in my opinion. So hopefully this is Mark DeSantis sort of saying, okay, yeah, we don't have time to get this team into a league now, but this is going to be a priority for us moving forward. And I did also sort of hear talking to some Vancouver people yesterday that they're really hoping that the USL2 does expand more in the West very quickly, and then they would absolutely be interested in coming in at that point. That's the scuttlebutt I'm hearing from the Whitecaps. So hopefully that happens.
And it might be a situation where the USL2, the money and the investment needed to get one of those teams running will be a lot lower than what the USL was a few years ago, when FC Montreal, when the Whitecaps 2 and a few others, two team were in that league. So maybe the threshold of I'm wasting my money and threshold of it's good for the development moves a little, and it goes maybe closer to it's an expense that's needed than just a wasting of money, which those two organizations, Montreal and Vancouver, decided to move away from in 2015 and 2017. So it's going to be interesting to see as well, those players that we met a few years ago from, when I say we met, not Carl we met, but as we met.
yeah.
But we met.
We
met a few years ago watching the USL. But no, that's going to be a fascinating thing to see. The beginning of USL 1, USL 2, the championship, the Canadian Premier League next year. So all those avenues for players to play. We'll see what the relationship between MLS teams, their reserve players, maybe being loaned out to, maybe not Canadian Premier League, which we would hope, but maybe USL 2 teams, standalones, USL 1, USL 2 teams. There's going to be a lot more place for professional soccer players to play starting in 2019 in the entirety of North America. So it's only a positive to find places to play for players that are fringe on your 18 to 23 man roster, and you can find a way to get them some experience. And that's one of the big thing with Maxime Crépeau too, Dwayne, is Maxime Crépeau was one of the players that benefited the most of FC Montreal. He literally played almost most games and was the one that was not getting any looks at the Montreal Impact at that level. And even though he played a couple games in the Canadian Championship 2 years ago, he never got that full chance. And back in the FC Montreal days, he was able to play regularly, week in, week out. Same for last year when he was the goalkeeper of the Ottawa Fury, goalkeeper of the year, shout-out record-breaking season with 15, and getting a shot with Vancouver Whitecaps. We'll see if he actually plays, if him and McMath, because McMath, let's go back to a year and a half ago before Tim Howard came. Colorado had over 2 points per game average with McMath in a 6 month period during the regular season. And we're like, what are they doing? Why are they signing Tim Howard? And we haven't looked back. They haven't looked up and we haven't looked back because, it was a wasted investment in my mind that Colorado did with Tim Howard. And they got rid of their best keeper because McMath right now is better.
Well, maybe they got him a new walker.
A new hip?
So that's not trying.
They changed the hip.
That's like fire logic to the Colorado Rapids, not Rapids. What the hell are they called? The Rapids, yeah.
The Rapids. You're
exactly,
right.
I followed the Rockies and the Rapids. I always mix it up in my head. This tells you how much the Colorado is relevant in this league, that I, a person who lives MLS 24/7, has to think about what their nickname is anyway.
Yeah, so that'll be fascinating. And there'll be a lot of moves today. Dwayne, if you were FC Cincinnati, what would you do today? Obviously, when you hear this show, it might be done already, the expansion draft, but how do you approach it? Do you just pick up five players to get those players into your roster, or do you go the LAFC route where you might get a player that you know does not want to leave his team, that you know the team doesn't want to let him go, but they kind of have to let him unprotected, and you get into an agreement with that team like, okay, well, we'll do a trade. You don't want us to pick him? And trade us something instead. Will we see that tactic today?
It's an asset, and I think you have to look at just like a draft pick. It's just an asset that has a certain level of value on it, and sometimes that value is the player, and sometimes that value is whatever allocation or whatever draft pick or whatever other player you can spin it into. And I think that's really how they'll approach it. This is a team that has shown some consistency in their roster building already. That wants to, I think, bring a few more players over from the USL level than we've seen with previous expansion teams. They're a little more Minnesota than they are Atlanta in terms of how they're building this, and whether that's translating. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they hope they're more Atlanta in terms of Minnesota when it comes to results, but
every club wish they were Atlanta.
Approach.
Right,
yeah, look, Cincinnati has been a great story in USL. When I asked Jonathan that question in the last segment, I don't know either, because they seem to be doing a lot of things right, but I don't get the sense they have the same level of investment potential as Atlanta does. So I do think they're going to launch a little closer to Minnesota than they than Atlanta would.
Who does? No one can do what Atlanta or LAFC has done. Even in LAFC, what they have done is a little bit below Atlanta. Like, who has 70,000 people week in, week out on games? Or at least not 70, like 50. The difference of revenue between 30 to 50, and no one has a 30,000 stadium. Like, it's, you can count them on one hand, the size, the 30,000 plus stadium in Major League Soccer. So, yeah, it's a amazing advantage that Atlanta has, and it's going to be hard. They set the bar really high, and that bar cannot be the expectations of every single team. It has to be like a pipe dream almost. Like, look, we want to come in. They have to think they're going to do like a Montreal in 2012, where we're going to finish six out of back then only five teams made the playoffs. So let's aim for being a playoff team or on the fringe of, and having a successful season where we don't get blown out and don't do 9 points in the entirety of the season. For me, when you look at Cincinnati, yes, a lot of players from the USL crop are going to make the transition. And two players that they acquired in 2018 and they played in the USL, Fatai Alache and Fernando Adi, those two players are MLS quality players. They have been playing for a long time in MLS and just agreed to spend a few months in USL to get acquainted to their team, the staff, the front office, the stadium, and their teammates, and then actually help the transition to Major League Soccer. But I think it's going to be a mix of all of it. When you look at FC Cincinnati, they do, I think, believe in the success. The success rate they did have over the last couple of years, that crop of players, and the fact that those players know each other can help the transition and not make a mixed match of misfits that you don't get along and don't have any chemistry. I think they do believe that chemistry is important. They're going to graft a few pieces to it, and they might have a decent 6th, 5th, 7th position of the rankings in the table for their first season. That's where I see them.
Yeah, well, the fact that Adi is their DP, tells you what their investment possibilities are. He's not a $10 million player. He is a $1 million player. You know what I mean? Maybe $1.5 million. He's a guy that can do a job there, but he's not going to be a superstar. He's just a solid player, right? And that's their investment there. And I think that they're looking at the potential of Tam and things like that. And that's the thing that what Tam has done that has sort of evened the playing field a little bit more than the, because the DPs, I think what was happening, and one of the reasons they brought Tam in, I think, was to provide, well, from the ownership perspective, was to provide the opportunity for those smaller market teams, the teams that don't feel that they can compete with the TFCs, with the Atlantas, with the Seattles, at the top end, LA Galaxy, and et cetera, for to bring the stars over in terms of the money they could expend, but because it's the same pot, right? Like, everyone's in the same playing field. It's just about your scouting and your ability to find the right fit when it comes to a TAM player. So I think that that's kind of their investment, that they're willing to put a shell a little out for an Audi because they think that he can, you know, score goals for them. And then they're going to go out and try and get the feel right with TAM players and surround them with the core that they had in Cincinnati last year, where they were, of course, they didn't do well in the playoffs, but they were a very good regular season team in USL. So that's their plan, and we'll see it. We'll see whether it works out for them. But I just don't think that when you're looking at the top end of the East and evaluating it next year, that you're necessarily going to put Cincinnati into that mix. They're more of a scramble it out for the playoff kind of team.
Yeah, that's exactly where I see them. All right, Dwayne, it's the end of our season, end of our regular season 2018. We're going to move on to season 5, I believe, when we come back in a week's time. But let's wrap up our 2018 coverage with those three here. Usually, some years we did have awards. It's been like an hour, like, oh, the awards here. We just got three for you today. Our low light of the year, our highlight of the year, and the Canadian player of the year. Let's start with the positive. Your highlight of the 2018 year?
I mean, I could say Atlanta, and that is something that's worthwhile, just the battle between Atlanta and New York. But I'm going to go way back because this is a show that is, and I'm based in Toronto, and I watched this firsthand, and I watched that second playoff run immediately after the playoff run last year, and the fact that TFC got one kick away, a missed sitter by Marchi Delgado from winning the CCL was an absolute highlight. And just watching those teams, watching Tigres come in and somehow finding a way down. And if I had to pinpoint it to one specific moment within all of that, it is Jonathan Rosario's spin back heel goal against Tigres at home. That is the only time I have seen, outside of MLS Cup, the Toronto press box gasp at a goal. It was that pretty to see live, and that unexpected, and that remarkable, and it kind of ended, you know, we'll see whether TFC can come back, but that was, you know, I think that moment and that run was the end of what was
the end of an era, amazing, the end of the run.
Yeah, it was an amazing 2.5 years, and it ended there, and, you know, everything collapsed, and we know what happened the rest of the season, but at that point in time, although the regular season wasn't going well, it certainly was a nice tapper, and had, you know, won the CCL, they'd be playing this Saturday. They would be playing this Saturday against a J-League team, the Antlers, and with the opportunity to play Real Madrid. That was how close they were. They were two games away from one, basically one game away, a penalty shootout and one win away from playing Real Madrid in a competitive game. Oh, what could have been, but that's my highlight.
Who knows? The way Real Madrid's doing this year, they could have beaten them, maybe. Well, we'll never know, won't we?
No, that's going to be crazy, but no.
My highlight of the year is easy, and I might be doing the cop-out thing by choosing Atlanta and the MLS Cup, but it's more 73,019 people at MLS Cup. It's the entirety of a city getting behind a team, getting behind a concept, getting behind an idea, and being able to achieve it. Seeing Tata Martino, having a chance to talk to Tata Martino earlier this year when he was in Montreal, that was a big highlight for me, just because, you know, sometimes you talk to someone, and in our field, we talk to a lot of people and directly involved in coaching or as a coach or as GM, and they answer your question, but they don't ponder your question. They don't try to actually convey their thought. And having to speak to Tata Martino through translator, I was not expecting anything. And I asked him a few questions. I asked him the question between what's the difference between a coach and an educator? And the way he was explaining the situation to me, even between a translator, he got me convinced. He was enthralled in that discussion. He was involved. He was he thought it was important for me to understand his answer, and he thought the question was important enough for him to spend time answering that question and educate us as well as educating his players. And I thought it was fascinating. And he will be a character that's missed in Major League Soccer. His two-year stay will have touched a lot of people in Major League Soccer, and that's my highlight of the year. Atlanta and Tata Martino for 2018. Bye-bye, Tata. See you later.
2018's almost over, yes. A couple weeks left. I guess that leads us to our low life. Kevin, I started the last one. You might as well start you this one.
All right, low light of the year. It's interesting. It would be easy for me to say, well, the Montreal Impact didn't make the playoff, but they did progress all season long. My low light of the year, I actually touched on it earlier today when Jonathan Tanwall asked me questions about Anthony Jackson and Mal, and it's the handling of this whole situation. A lot of it has to be put on the player. That's what I'm saying, too. And it's unfortunate. Good talent, good efficiency in front of the net that's being wasted for pedantic reasons on either side. And that's a shame. It's a shame. Shame someone from our province, a homegrown, a player that went through the ranks, will be leaving the Montreal Impact. And I'm not blaming the Impact for this one, but it's a shame. Talent wasted.
Yeah, hopefully we can find someone else. Sometimes, I mean, it could just be a frustration thing, too, when both parties, you know, anyone who's been in a fight that never seems to end with some person out there knows that, you know, sometimes you're trying your best, but there's too much, you know, there's too much blood in the water, so to speak, right? And
yeah,
you just need to move on. So
I agree, but you're in a hierarchical situation, whatever that word is. There's a hierarchy, right? When you professional sports is not a democracy, right? It's not. You have someone in charge, and you gotta listen to that person in charge. And if you don't, there's consequences. And if you don't do as you're told, and it's unfortunate because in life you should not necessarily do as you're told in a lot. But in this sports situation, when your coach asks you to do certain things, you gotta do them. And it's unfortunate that personalities got involved in this, and it's a shame that once the bridge is cracked and close to collapsing, it's hard to build it up again, and this time just goes on, and the water actually passes under the bridge without any resolution. And we'll see today, but yeah, that whole situation for me is a shame, because if we would have this conversation last year, Anthony Jackson ML could have won the Canadian Player of the Year. But this year, he's my low light.
Yeah, I mean, I think he is considered a domestic based on the new rule. So it's not a bad shout for Cincinnati to take a risk on some guy like that, too. So that's just hope for everyone's sake that he can find somewhere else. But as you say, it won't be in Montreal. My low life is a little topical in terms of it's happening right now. But I do think that it's important to sort of speak to this a little bit. And it's more going to be kind of a overriding situation. I'm going to call it the dark side of football. The dark side of football reemerging. We saw it with River Boca, with all that bloody mess, and we didn't talk about, obviously, River winning at the end because the game was overshadowed by the mess that was happening. I'm talking about stuff like just hooliganism sort of raising up against racism in parks. Raheem Sterling with his post on Instagram the other day having to call out people on what, you know, whistle, you know, what racism is, what it's feels like as a player. I just wish we could move on as a society from this stuff. And obviously within our little tiny part of society, we're still seeing it, and we're seeing it flare up. And so that's my low life of the year. Thankfully we didn't have the World Cup marred by it, but God knows it was probably beneath the surface there. Who knows what was happening in the stadiums that we weren't seeing. So, and we didn't talk about the World Cup as our highlights, which is another highlight, obviously. But, yeah.
It's like hopefully I forgot about it. France winning the World Cup is my highlight, Dwayne. Never mind. Never mind whatever I said. Never mind Atlanta. France. Allez les Bleus. Deux étoiles.
There you go. Yeah, well, it seems like ages ago. So much happened since. That's the thing about what we do. Is that 6 months ago might as well be 16 years, right? In so many ways, it seems like forever ago. But the low-life stuff and that Sterling stuff, you know, Raheem Sterling is, obviously he frustrates people because he goes down easy in the box, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When he was younger, especially, that happened. But a lot of what he gets has everything to do with the fact that He's not a white person. So, yeah.
We all read those articles where the amount of time he is being targeted by the tabloids versus another player with a different color of skin for the exact same behaviors, if not worse, for criminal behaviors on the white person's part that are not even talked about, like players leaving on a jet, going gambling somewhere, partying, and coming back, and no one talks about it. But then he does something wrong. He just looks at someone the wrong way, and there's two articles and three tabloids on it the next day. No, that is unfortunate, and it has to be overtly exposed as racism, unfair treatment of one player versus the other. And if you want to go down that route, Daily Mirror and other places, you gotta be consistent about, you want to talk about one player because you want to, he does one thing wrong, well, talk about the 200 players that you don't talk about that do even worse things.
Well, yeah, the Instagram post is a perfect example. He purposely did this. He did not pick an article that was about him. He picked an article about a black young teammate who bought his mother a home. And this person splashed out 2.5 million pounds on a home for his mom. And they're saying this in this negative sort of connotation way. And Raheem Sterling points out in the post that a white player at City, Phil Foden, did the same damn thing, and they didn't write an article about it. I mean, there's a more overt example of a double standard. I don't know what it is, right? And I don't know. The dark side of football is my negative, and it seems maybe it's just because society, it's flaring up more and more. Maybe it's because we're more exposed to it because people aren't willing to put up with it anymore. I don't know, but it seems to me like that's something that needs to be addressed in 2019.
Oh, yeah, definitely needs to. It should have been addressed in 2010, but alas.
Or 2001 or 1910, whatever, but yeah.
Yeah, we should know better. And when I say we, I mean the media as a whole, we should know better. There's always slippery slopes. And you always have a decision-making process. Do you go on that slope? Can you justify yourself? Why are you doing it? What's your reasoning behind writing that article? Is it truly news, or are you trying to create a narrative? Are you trying to drive that narrative to the ground? It's always a question that we have to be honest with ourselves. But now it's time. Canadian Player of the Year, Dwayne. Go ahead. I think you have a list in front of you two. Let us know the choices available, and I'll tell you who my Canuck of the Year is.
Well, basically any player that played on the national team at some point or the players are on the short list, because the short list is never very short for the Canadian Soccer Association for their Player of the Year.
200
they just
players.
List everyone.
Here's the short list.
I'll tell you what my vote was. On the women's side of the game, I went with Katisha Buchanan again. That's the second year in a row I voted for her, and it largely has to do with her club side of the play. And when I vote for Canadian Player of the Year, and I do have a vote for Canadian Player of the Year, I used to sort of go 60-40, but I'd flip it, men and women, 60-40, 60% club, 40% national team for the men, and 60% national team and 40% club for the women. But I'm kind of increasingly at least getting up to 50-50 with the women as the club game and the club level gets better and better. So Kadisha Buchanan, because she won the Champions League, and that's an accomplishment that very few Canadians can say
we'll
her.
Ever do,
and
it's a few Canadians, yeah, can ever say that, men or women, we won the I won the Champions League, those four words.
On Hargreaves was a Canadian when he won the Champions League with Bayern Munich. That would be the only other off the top of my head that I can think of. So yes, this is, to me, that's an accomplishment that she was a regular player on that team. You know, if anything, her national team play is a little terrifying sometimes. She's a little too aggressive for my taste, but nonetheless, she was my Player of the Year vote. I put Sinclair was second in my voting, and I put Heidemann, Jordan Heidemann, because of her play of the U-17s as my third place vote, which is a little scary that I had to pick a third place vote. Jesse Fleming would have been in my consideration as well, simply because of her play in the NCAA, but she didn't have... Because of national team exposure, she didn't have as much of a role in the NCAA this year, and their UCLA came up short. So I decided to keep her on my top three list, Kevin. My men's list, I'll let you jump in after I give my men's list. I did not vote for Alphonso Davies. He will win. I'm almost certain of that because his exposure is such that in the vote goes to a lot of people that are more general than soccer specific reporters. So that's why Sinclair will probably win the women's game too.
That's crazy.
So I think Alphonso Davies will probably win this thing. And I did actually put him second on my poll because he had an amazing season and it's not just hype. Like you look at him, I like the advanced numbers. He like was top 10 in MLS in terms of the who scored ranking. So like he had a hell of a season in MLS and he obviously is now the darling of Bayern Munich, and there's a lot of pressure on that kid now. I have a search on him, so whatever news comes up, and the Bayern fans are like, I can't wait for this kid to play. And it's, part of that's just because they're frustrated with the season, of course. But beyond that, there's a lot of potential there, and you know they're hyping him up pretty good, and they know what they're doing. So that's a player that you know I think is worthwhile as your number two pick. I picked Scott Arfield third. Again, he's having a great time at Rangers. I think he's been an absolute stalwart for the national team as a captain. Deserves a lot of credit for fully investing. I mean, this is the guy that didn't grow up in Canada, that never set foot in Canadian soil until he represented the country. And I don't mean that in a negative way. He came here and he fully is invested and fully is committed to being a leader for the Canadian national team. Hey, so he is my pick for third.
He was injured in St. Kitts and Nevis. But he was still there. He didn't have to travel. He didn't have to go there, but he was because he believes in the project.
Precisely. So he was my third pick. Lucas Cavallini was actually my player of the year pick. And I'm guessing I'm going to be one of the few people that put him that close. And that has everything to do with his remarkable season in Mexico. The breakthrough player for a Canadian to go down to Liga MX and have not just excel, but to star for a team that has a bit of history. He's linked to a lot of bigger clubs for a bigger move now. And I think because of his club play and his success on the club level that I have ranked him there. My fourth pick would have been Jonathan Rosario because of his remarkable season for TFC. I think that TFC's overall play failure to make the playoffs would have knocked him off of that ranking.
No, Piet. Samuel Piet played all but 80 minutes in Major League Soccer this year. Played a few games with the national teams as well. 90 minutes in the St. Kitts and Nevis game. Saved maybe a saved a goal opportunity by taking a yellow card for the team. Me, I agree with you, Lucas Cavallini. Lucas Cavallini would be my Canadian of the year. Atiba would be in that discussion too. But I put Samuel Piet in my top three just because of the season he had in Major League Soccer. His undeniable value and worth for the Montreal Impact. If it's not for him, the midfield would have looked bleak all season long. He does a ungratifying job for every team that he plays for in front of the defense, stopping balls, starting the attack. And for me, Samuel Piet is one of the top three Canadians this year in the professional game. Maybe I'm stretching it a bit, but for me, it would be Lucas Cavallini, Atiba, and Samuel Piet. Those are my top three. For the women, I agree with you. And I would have maybe Haitema second and St. Clair third. But the same. Khadisha Buchanan, Champions League winner. She has to be number one. But the men's side, I would go Cavallini, Piet, Atiba. Or interchangeable, the second and third. But that's my top three.
Yes. Well, like I said, Davies and Sinclair will win. I mean, Sinclair did not win a couple. Buchanan won it a few years ago. But that was during the World Cup year because people saw her.
Yeah.
That's the thing. People just don't see them, so they just vote Sinclair by default. And here's the thing about default Sinclair too. We didn't really talk about her. We just said, well, obviously she's in the top three. Basically, she is still a remarkable story, a remarkable player, one of the greatest Canadian athletes of all time. The Lou Marsh Award, which is Canadian Athlete of the Year, is being named today. It might even be out by now by the time we have this conversation. So I'm always something I enjoy because it's a debate about all sports and trying who values there and where hockey players fit in and all that. It's a fascinating discussion each year. I think it will probably be Tessa and Scott together, but that's neither here nor there. But this Christine Sinclair is the only soccer player to have ever won it. And that's a remarkable accomplishment in this country. And this speaks to how much she has crossed over, so to speak. So, we shouldn't ever just ignore her, but we do take her for granted because she's just been so good for so long.
Yeah, we'll know later on. I just checked while you were talking. It's not out yet, so we're not going to be able to tell you on air before we come back who the actual recipient of the Lou Marsh Award is, but it's fascinating. On this note, we bid you goodbye for a week. You can follow Dwayne on social media at 24th Minute, myself at Kev Larme, and at Soccer Today SBN. We'll be back during next week. It has to be talked about between Dwayne and I when we actually come back. I'm going on a few days off and shutting my phone off, and we'll see. But until then, make sure you keep on subscribing and talking about the show. Make sure you catch up on the episode that you have missed over the last few days and weeks. And as always, we want to thank you for your support. And if you like what we do, you can always support us at patreon.com/sportspodcastingnetwork and help us get better equipment for both Dwayne and I in the future by giving us a little hand on Patreon. And until next time, as always, we wish you great holidays and a great soccer.
You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcast.